Yeah, this impromptu Dhamma talk as opposed to the highly organized Dhamma talks that we usually have. But as I mentioned before, actually the main reason for wanting to give a talk tonight was because I just enjoyed so much last night here with Bhante Akachitta, so I thought, oh, we should do it again. But also just wanted to say a few words before leaving over the Christmas period. And as we haven't had any teaching content for the last little while, just wanted to try to share some Dhamma and so on before, to give you something to reflect on over the next few weeks. But maybe let's start with doing some guided meditation for the next 10-15 minutes or so. So we finally get the chance to make use of this beautiful hall that's been created through so much work, time and effort, and dedication, thought, care, concern, donations, intelligence, sweat, blood, all the rest of those things, death, all of the living beings that have died to make this hall, insects that were squashed by the trucks that brought the materials here, animals that were living in the trees that died. Can't get away from it. It's the ambiguity of samsara, the ambiguity of existence. It's inherently mixed up with good and evil, suffering and pleasure, life and death. Any kind of teaching which only wants to look at one side of that equation is in the pursuit of folly. So this is one of the things that Nagarjuna was trying to point out when he tried to very subtly, in his very subtle way, undermine the distinction between Nibbana and Samsara. He didn't make any crude statements to the effect that Nibbana and Samsara are the same. Being a very subtle philosopher, he phrase things in a way which kind of repays careful attention. One of the statements he made is that there's no distinction between Nibbana and Samsara. It's a very kind of subtle kind of statement. You can say, well, it's quite different from saying Nibbana and Samsara are the same. But if you say there's no distinction, it's a negative statement. There's a lack of something which is a distinction. So then you have to understand, well, what does it mean to make the distinction? Of course, so when you begin to reflect on that, you realize that a distinction, there's no kind of hard and fast boundary line, which is like an impermeable barrier. There's no, if you try to define the difference between Nibbana and Samsara, then you're always kind of running into problems. So your attempts to conceptualize and clarify that philosophically are always going to, in the end, be less than satisfactory or less than perfect. And so this kind of thinking helps us to avoid a kind of too much of a sense of idealism in our approach to Dhamma practice. You know, kind of the idea that there's some thing, some attainment over there which we have to reach for and we have to get to. We have to get to jhanas, we have to get to nibbana, we have to get to stream entry, we have to get to Buddhahood, however we want to conceive, however the goal that appears in our mind. Yeah. And there's this kind of idea that somehow we're over here and the goal is over there. And if we think and reflect in this way, then that gives rise to what the Buddhists called spiritual depression, niramisa domanasa. So spiritual depression, a kind of longing, you know, for those dhammas which you haven't attained. Longing to be over there, you know, the distant fields kind of fallacy. So to, of course, if we don't have that idea, then the counterpart of that is, if we don't conceive of the goal as being something which is exalted and purified and perfect, then it's difficult for us to raise the energy to strive to attain it. And we can be very complacent in what we think is an adequate commitment of time or effort or energy to attain that goal. So, for example, if we think that you know, getting jhanas is a very simple matter, then maybe we can, you know, think that we can do a weekend retreat and pop into a few jhanas on the weekend and then go back to work the next Monday. And you know, we think that we're really getting somewhere. In fact, it's just self-delusion. So the idea, the kind of the maintaining that concept of the purity and the height, the exaltedness of spiritual aspirations is, I think, quite essential. It's certainly presented in that way by the Buddha. And if we look in the suttas, that constantly he's referring to a very high expectation of a spiritual aim. He was always calling people out to excel themselves, to do better than they thought that they were possible, that they thought was possible for them. And so this idea of like striving to reach, to attain something. But on the other hand, that idea is also predicated on a quite different set of assumptions, which is that basically we're all similar. We all are comprised of the five khandhas. We all have a physical body. We have feelings, we have perceptions, we have thoughts and intentions, we have a consciousness and an awareness of those things. And no matter who we are, whether the Buddha or anybody else, we work in pretty much the same kind of way. You know, and this applies not even in the human realm, but also to the animal realm. You know, so in Buddhism, we're not making a hard and fast distinction between the human realm and the animal realm. It's interesting to follow the scientific research in that, and that it seems always that there's this attempt to draw, this idea of a distinction, a visesa, between humans and animals, to say, you know, the distinction is that humans use language and animals can't use language, or whatever the thing may be. To say that there's a hard and fast distinction between humans and animals. And of course, once you postulate that kind of distinction, immediately somebody goes and does some research to prove that, well, it's not actually the case, and that there actually you can find those kinds of things in animals. And so again, it's this thing you can't... Obviously, we know what's the difference between a human and an animal, but if you try to make that visesa, try to define that in a particular way, then it becomes a bit flubbly, to use a technical term. And this is, of course, one of the great problems that we come up with again and again in the history of philosophy and so on. And one of the great problems with the we were talking earlier about the Abhidhamma project is it was an attempt to eliminate the flubbing and to make everything clear-cut and defined in black and white. And, of course, it's doomed to failure. And I remember a very good reflection on that by Vipassana once, and he was very good on that kind of thing. And we were talking once about a particular vinaya problem, and I remember talking with the Venerable Siripanyo, And in the Vinaya, you have two categories of things. They're called Lahubandha and Garubandha. And they're treated quite differently in the Vinaya, that Lahubandha is light stuff. Bandha means stuff. Lahu means light stuff. So light stuff, which can be treated in certain ways under the Vinaya, and then Garubandha is heavy stuff, which needs to be treated in different ways according to the Vinaya. So we kind of draw this distinction. And Venerable Siripanyo made the remark, and I think what he said was that you know, one way of seeing the difference is that light stuff was things that you might take with you if you were leaving a monastery. Okay, so there might be things that you might pack in your bag and take with you on the road, whereas heavy stuff would be things that actually stayed in the monastery. And Ajahn Pasana was, I can't remember if that's exactly what he said, but that was, I think it was something along those lines. And then Ajahn Pasana's response was, yeah, that sounds reasonable, it probably sounds reasonable until you start to think about it. So it's very much Ajahn Pasana's style, and I think very apt in that circumstance. You know, again, that drawing the boundary line, light stuff and heavy stuff, you want to draw the distinction, but yeah, when you more you start to think about it, the more the differences fade. And this is something, again, I was discussing with Bhante Agachitta about the, we were discussing about Sikkhamana training this morning. And, you know, different aspects of it. And I said that, you know, the more you look into it, the less clear you are about actually what is meant. And taking it on a very kind of simple surface level, it seems very black and white. This is A, this is B, that's fine. But then the more you look at it, it seems, well, there's these crossovers and they sort of dissolve. And at the end of the day, you don't quite know what's going on. So that kind of aspect of not quite knowing what's going on is I think, quite healthy. And it means that you have to act from certain humility, that, well, you make a judgment about what you think is okay and the right thing to do, but really there are different ways of looking at it. Yeah? As you can emphasize, you can pick up certain aspects of something, emphasize them. It looks clear if you can pick up certain other aspects and emphasize them. And, you know, which is the right one? Yeah. And I remember one of my philosophy tutors commented on this, and he was saying he was kind of disillusioned. He wanted to write a book on the philosophy of the mind and philosophy of perception, and he said, you know, he's kind of problem is he's always going to go in to write his book, and then he realizes somebody's already written a book about what he was going to write it about, and then whenever he reads that book, he always finds it very persuasive, you know, but then he reads the next book and he finds that just as persuasive as well, and then he reads the next one and that's also very persuasive. So in the end, what is there? What where is that certainty? And of course the answer to that is there is no certainty. And that the search for certainty is the search for something which doesn't exist. So in the suttas and so on, they and especially not so much in the suttas, but in the later tradition, they talk about the flowers, the sky flowers. Yeah. So sky flowers, something which doesn't exist. Yeah? Or they talk about the horns of a rabbit. Yeah. So something which doesn't exist, like a rabbit doesn't have horns. So if you want to find a certainty about what we're doing, we're going to be disappointed. We're expecting too much. Right? So rather than trying to always find certainty, trying to always clarify things, trying to always, you know, see if things are going to fit in some kind of black and white situation, then it's much more useful to learn to appreciate uncertainty and to be able to operate in a world which has an acceptable degree of uncertainty, because that is in fact the world that we live in. So once we realize that there's not these kind of hard and fast distinctions between things, then when we start to look at this concept of spiritual aspiration, then we realize there's not so much of a problem or a divorce there. Okay, in the sense that, for example, maybe we think, well, I want to find jhanas. Okay, so I want to practice. I want to get jhanas because jhanas are part of the Eightfold Path. There's something the Buddha recommended and encouraged, and is a necessary condition for the deep insight which leads to liberation. So I want to practice jhanas. But the reality is that my mind is completely messed up, full of hindrances, full of turmoil, completely lacking in clarity. How can I, who is sitting here, get over there to that state of purity? I can listen to Ajahn Brahm's talks, and he'd be talking about the blissful mind, the beauty of the mind, the clarity and the power and so on of jhanas, or this thing over there. But what about me? Where is my mind at? So we have to reflect and realize that there's no, again, it gets that if we say so, there's no intrinsic ultimate difference between my mind now and the mind in jhanas. Okay, and so this again is what that teaching of like the mind is naturally radiant is sort of getting towards, you know. And of course we've discussed this, that that idea is not actually an idea from the suttas. Okay, the Buddha never said the mind is naturally radiant, but the point of it is to point to the fact that the mind which is developed in jhanas and developed in samadhi is not different in kind from the mind, the everyday mind that we have here and now. Okay, so we make a distinctions. So we have to make distinctions which are constructs of language, so that we can talk about things. And this is what Ajahn Chah said when, you know, people, he was asked about the original mind. He said, "Well, how can you say Nibbana is the original mind?" And he said, "Well, it's original. Like, you know, if you have the cup here." And you move the cup away, then you can say, well, that's the original spot. Yeah? That's the original place where the cup was. Yeah? Actually, there's no cup there, but that's the original place. And he said, so it's just a word that you, but it's actually gone. It disappeared. So this is a word that we use so that we can talk to each other, otherwise we just have to grunt. And if you've ever been lived in Isan, northeast Thailand, you know that they manage to grunt quite eloquently, actually. It's quite a normal part of the conversation. So you could actually go quite a long way in discussion just with grunts. Well, they do, in fact. So we use the words, but because we don't mistake the words for the things themselves. So within our mind, as we sit here now, we can feel a sense of movement. Yeah? So there may be various kinds of, if we look at the mind as we're sitting here, there's various kinds of aspects or dimensions of movement inside the mind. Yeah? On the one hand, maybe is the mind moving in the sense of going around to different objects, so it's like hearing the sound. You can hear the kookaburras, you can hear that block of wood there in the back, you can hear my voice. Yeah? So there's different sounds, different sights. Yeah? Smell, you can smell a bit of the varnish smell. Yeah, feelings in the body, if you're sitting there on the floor, probably getting a bit of pain in the sitting posture and so on. So all of these different kinds of things. So the mind's moving around there from one to the other, but also moving inside itself, like another dimension of moving. It's moving from thoughts, yeah, the narrative and so on. The focus of attention is shifting. Yeah, sometimes when you're listening to the talk, other times the attention drifts. You know, you get caught up in your own train of thought, and you have to bring it back to the talk again. Otherwise, the emotions come up, and then that takes your attention for a period of time. And so there's this kind of internal shifting, as well as the external moving to different things, an internal shifting kind of mosaic. But then inside that, there's kind of a more subtle shifting of the shape of consciousness, that it's kind of like it's not a solid block, but it's more kind of globbly, and it kind of extrudes itself in various directions, like a bunch of, like a lump of Play-Doh that kind of point out in various directions. And then inside that, there's another level of movement where the mind vibrates, and there's an agitation, like a kind of an atomic oscillation that's happening as kind of vibration on a very subtle level, and so on. So that these are, you know, this is the flexibility of the mind, the movingness of the mind. And yet at the same time, the mind is quite still. It's still here, isn't it? All the time that we've been sitting here in the talk, your mind is actually here inside your body, in some sense, in a perceptual sense. It's actually, there's a seat of awareness here. There's a constancy in the feeling of, well, this is my consciousness. We're not confronted from moment to moment with something completely unrecognizable that's alien to us, okay? When that happens, then we recognize, well, this is a kind of mental illness, isn't it? We call it schizophrenia. As you're kind of confronted with completely kind of alien things, you know, voices and so on, which is like split off bits of your own mind which have got nothing to do with you. Yeah? And so that we realize that this is the mind which is fragmented and disintegrated. But normally our mind is not like that. Normally it has some degree of integration. And that integration is what we mean when we talk about samadhi and one-pointedness. Okay, so of course it's at a different level to the integration that happens when we realize samadhi. But it's the same kind of thing. It's not a different kind of thing. So even within all of that movement, we recognize that the movement is real, and yet the stillness is also real. Similarly, we can point to, like in samadhi, there's a brightness in the mind, an illumination of the mind. And of course, when we look at our mind normally, we don't see so much illumination. The mind can seem very dark, very dull, grey clouds, and we don't see all that clearly. That's something which you can't necessarily tell. You can't until you have a standing point. Okay, so once you've stepped out of the grey clouds, and you know you stand in the sunshine, then you know what the greyness is like. Yeah, and you realise that our mind is like that, and that when we step out into the sunshine, into samadhi, then there's a dazzling brightness which is quite different from the ordinary consciousness. And yet, even though we recognize that they're different, but still there's a continuity there. It's not a completely different kind of thing. And so there's this, even within the most grey or dull or dark state of mind, there's still some awareness. Yeah? Unless maybe you're falling asleep or something like that, but just generally speaking, you know, there's some light there. It's not completely black. And so there has to be this appreciation of this continuity or not continuity, but this lack of absoluteness to ideas of sameness and difference. Of course, this is exactly what the Buddha pointed to in the Sanyutta Nikaya, the Sabbang Ekatang, Ayang Eko Anto. Everything is unity. This is one extreme. Sabbang Nanatang, Ayang Dutiyo Anto. Everything is a diversity. This is a second extreme. Ete te ubhavante anupagamma. Not going to those two extremes. Majjhena dhammang desemi. I teach the Dhamma by the middle, which of course is dependent origination. So what we perceive, what our world of experience is a web and a matrix of relationship. Relationship between inner and outer. Between a sense organ and the sense objects. We see what happens when those things come together, we call contact. And in that one word, pasa, and the coming together of those three things, the eye, the object, and the eye consciousness, is pasa, is contact. And right there we see the germ of those philosophical problems which we were discussing earlier. And the Pali says, Dhyanang Sangati Paso, the coming together of the three is contact. So contact actually isn't anything. Right? According to that understanding, contact actually isn't anything. It's the coming together of those three. It's those the relationship between the sense organ, the sense object, and the consciousness. That particular relationship, that constellation, is called pasa. But of course, this contradicts with the Abhidhamma idea that pasa is a swabhava dhamma. It's something which exists independently in and of itself. And so the commentary glosses that phrase. Instead of Dhyanang Sangati Paso, it says Dhyanang Sangatiya Paso. From the coming together of the three is contact. Okay, so it's quite a different thing. The sutta is saying the coming together of the three is contact. The commentaries say from the coming together of the three is contact. Yeah, two quite different things. Contact, according to the commentaries, is a distinct, self-existent Dhamma, which is caused by the other three things. According to the suttas, contact is in fact nothing more than the relationship between. So this is what our world consists of. It doesn't come prepackaged. Our experience doesn't come wrapped in plastic and labelled with a list of ingredients on the side. It comes in a mess. Kalapahana used to call the big, buzzing, blooming confusion. And that's what we kind of see when we wake up in the morning, is this big, buzzing, blooming confusion. So we try to make sense of that, using language, using concepts, and so on. We try to make sense of that. And of course, the language and the concepts that we use are entirely and fundamentally determined by the culture that we're in. We live in a different culture, we have a different language, a different set of categories, we apply that to our experience in different ways, and we therefore shape and direct our experience in different ways and create different realities according to the different language that we use. Again, this is one of the problems of trying to make a hard and fast distinction between ultimate and conventional reality, because the fact of our consciousness is that these things constantly interrelate, that our conceptualization of the world is essential in creating the fact of experience. Even if, for example, we sit down to do vipassana meditation, we think, I'm going to do vipassana meditation, I'm going to see ultimate reality, okay, which is free of conceptual proliferation. Okay, the very fact that we can sit down to do that is dependent on the fact that we've heard the word vipassana meditation beforehand. Okay, so that word, vipassana, the teaching, the oral teaching of a meditation technique, is moving us towards and creating that reality of us sitting there to meditate. And that is what they call in the Abhidhamma, the Pure Jata Pachaya, is the previously existing condition for that experience of vipassana, experience of insight, which is supposedly free of conditions. Not free of conditions, free of concepts. Of course, it's not free of concepts. It's conditioned by concepts in all kinds of ways. So as Buddhist practitioners and as Dhamma practitioners, it is a part of the Buddhist culture that we have we have a sense of and have an idea of the transcendent of what we call Nibbana, is the highest Dhamma. And you know, say, what do you mean by highest? The Dhamma, you say, well, whatever Dhamma, whatever thing you think of as being the highest, it's higher than that. It's a relative state or a relative concept. As a concept, I mean, I'm not saying that the thing itself is relative. That's another philosophical problem. But the concept of Nibbana is a relative concept. And part of what underlies and defines and informs the nature of us as a Buddhist community is the fact that we are practicing for Nibbana. And that's our goal. We're not practicing to get reborn in heaven. We're not practicing to be reborn with the oneness of the universe or whatever it may be. We have this idea of Nibbana. Of course, we can't agree what Nibbana is, but that doesn't seem to matter too much from a practical point of view. So that puts everything that we do in a context. Okay. So remember that the Buddha has said that the Noble Eightfold Path is a conditioned Dhamma. So what we're doing on the path is not unconditioned. It's conditioned. It's part of the conditioned realm. And this is what the Zen saying is getting at when it says, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. And it's supposed to be kind of very shocking and very Zen, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. Well, of course, the Buddha isn't on the road. The Buddha's already at the end of the road. And he's already walked the path. So whatever you meet on the path is not the Buddha. So if we lose sight of this, if we lose sight of that goal of Nibbana and that aspiration, then we really lose the context that makes us special as a Buddhist community. You know, then that's when a transcendental religion becomes turned into just a means of therapy, or just a way of life, or just a culture, or something like that. So all of those things are part of what we're doing, but they don't. But what we're doing can't be reduced to that. What we're doing can't be reduced to being a therapy. Can't be reduced to being a culture. Can't be reduced to being a nice environment, a way to live, and so on and so forth. And so when we think like that, then we have to try to reflect or try to understand that Nibbana is something which actually is present among us. And that whenever we shift our mind, you know, the Nibbana the Buddha described as being the absence of greed, hatred and delusion. So we know what that's like, don't we? We know what it's like to have greed, and we know what it's like when that greed ends. We know what it's like to have hatred, we know what it's like to have that hatred ends. We know what it's like to have delusion, and I don't know, do we know what it's like to have delusion end? Maybe, maybe not. But at least we know what it's like relatively to have those things end. We might not know absolutely, but we've got some idea. We've been in a state of confusion, and then later on we found clarity. So that's not something which is, you know, off there in the distance. It's not something in the clouds. It's not something in fairy lands. It's not something we have to make this kind of huge leap of faith about. We have to make perhaps a large step of faith. Okay, so we can understand greed, hatred, and delusion. Yes, we can see that. We can see it causes suffering, and we can see that when it's lessened, that it causes less suffering. Okay, so then we still have a gap of faith to say, well, you can get rid of it completely, and then completely get rid of suffering. So there's still, as long as we're not enlightened, there's still a movement of faith there. But it's not like a leap into the unknown. It's not like a kind of acceptance of something which is completely other. It's a consummation of the path and the understanding which we already have. And so in that sense, you know, Nibbana is something which is brought into being by conditions, in the sense that one practicing it has to practice the conditioned Dhamma of the Eightfold Path. But in a sense, is there already. And just like this hall that we're sitting in is a constructed dhamma. It's put together by bits and pieces, put together by effort and by sweat and by work. And having been put together by effort and by material and by matter and by energy and all of those things, it then encapsulates a space. So the purpose of the building is not the wood, it's not the paint, it's not the rafters. The purpose of the building is the space which is left by all of those things. And so in the same way that our Dhamma practice, the work that we do into the practice, the effort we take in our meditation, the struggling, the trying to perfect different aspects of the path and all of these kinds of things, these are the things which make the space of Nibbana possible, make it possible for us to realize that. But in a sense, you can say that the space that we're in now, I mean, it gets very philosophical, but what did the space exist before the building was here? Well, that's when you sort of get into the metaphysics of it. But practically speaking, there's work, and then the result of that work is the realization of that space. And so in that sense, is Nibbana is similar to the space in that sense, that there's the work which is done, which is concrete, which involves things, actual specific things to do. And then the result of that is something which is not specific. So this is my little talk for you this evening on Nibbana and Samsara.
Thank you.